Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. I just finished up a great conversation with Arsen Thagupsov, who is the head of social media at Relay and also writer of the weekly Bitcoin Therapist newsletter. We had a fantastic discussion. We covered everything. It seemed like why we have passion for Bitcoin, how we share that passion with other people, approaching everyone as individuals with empathy and communicating our messages accordingly about Bitcoin. We talked about his role at Relay and promoting Bitcoin content on social media, among many other things. I hope you'll enjoy this. I think you certainly will, and would love your feedback, obviously, at the end of the episode. Enjoy. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Arsen here with me. Arsen, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I appreciate you taking time. So we're going to... I think you're an interesting guest. We're probably going to cover a lot of ground. Where I like to begin with everyone, I love to understand how people came to Bitcoin, what it was that brought them in, and what resonated that made them interested enough to be the type of person that would be invited onto a Bitcoin podcast.
Yeah, I mean, my story is pretty standard, and I feel like I've told it a few times already, but essentially I was a broke student, and I was looking for a way to make money. So I ended up on a random Facebook group about investing. Then I saw a link to Coinbase. Like, somebody was obviously trying to earn some referrals. So I clicked that and ended up buying the top of 2017 bull market. That would have been probably the 20th of December 2017. I think I literally bought the top. And then I wrote it down all the way to 3K. And so, that's my story in a nutshell. Obviously, I wasn't into just Bitcoin. I was a huge shitcoiner before. But, you know, when you have 2 years, you know, you're riding down from all-time high 2 years and you're in the negative, you have lots of time to kind of contemplate and think about what you did. And after those 2 years, I came out. I became Bitcoin only mostly.
Yeah. So, did you have conviction in Bitcoin to have ridden it down? Were you selling along the way, or panicking, or anything, or did you already have sort of that high conviction in Bitcoin to take it down to, you know, to $3,000?
So in the beginning, it wasn't about conviction. It was kind of like, either I make money or I lose it all. It wasn't a substantial amount where I was worried. So to me, this money didn't exist. So like, I didn't have that much money. So to me, it's like, if I lost it, then whatever. But then I knew that there was a potential of making money. But then after maybe 1 year, definitely with every day that I spent on Bitcoin Twitter and spent reading Bitcoin articles, listening to Bitcoin podcasts, my conviction grew. And, I don't think I've ever sold a single sat.
That's great. So yeah, I think that's probably a common, you know, like I came into, I would say that podcasts in particular were the thing that sort of began to resonate with me. I started reading newsletters. I'm actually a recent subscriber to yours. I want to talk a little bit about that. You've got a few roles within the Bitcoin community these days. You're social media lead at a company called Relay. I'd love to start by just hearing a little bit about Relay, what you all are working on, what you do, for anyone who isn't familiar.
Sure. So Relay is Europe's easiest Bitcoin app. So our focus is really simple. So we're Bitcoin only, and we just focus on making long-term Bitcoin savings as easy as possible. And what I do specifically at Relay is shit posting, mostly on Twitter. So I get paid to do that. So that's a dream job, but also like all kinds of social media stuff. I didn't have any social media experience before joining Relay, but like all the companies I've worked for, it's always been, like I've always first been a user and then I became an employee. So it was the same with Relay. I heard Julian on Daniel Prince's podcast, and then I just messaged him because it was still easy to message him back then because Relay was super small. I think I was employee number six, maybe something like that. So I just messaged him on Telegram, and I sent him a few meme ideas, and I just kept pestering him, essentially just adding value, like proposing ideas, saying that I can help for free, because I really wanted to work for Relay. I think Relay's vision was very much aligned with mine, and it was perseverance. You know, I was just adding so much value that eventually he had to hire me part time and then eventually full time. So I was just being super super annoying to him and harassing him in DMs until he gave me a job.
So is everything like if I see Relay posting on Twitter, that's you. You're the.
So
like, for the last team, or do you have other people who are helping?
So Relay is a small team. We're probably 23 full-time employees. The social media team for the last 3 years was just me. I've always said the social media team when it was just me, but now for like 1 month we now have a social media intern, Jordi. So he also, if you see a bad post on Twitter, you can blame him and not me, but he's also helping me.
You have an alibi. That's good. So yeah, you spend all day long thinking and talking about Bitcoin. And this is a question I'm always dying to know, because it's such, I think this is the hardest question I could possibly ask you, but how would you briefly explain Bitcoin to someone, like someone who, you know, a cousin, friend, someone who just has no concept of maybe the problem that exists or why Bitcoin's necessary? How would you begin that conversation?
Well, like you said, most people don't have a context. It's like, I used to be that guy who was screaming from the rooftops how amazing Bitcoin is and how it fixes everything. Spoiler alert, it doesn't fix everything, but I was that guy. And you don't want to be the Bitcoin guy at the party who's like trying to orange pill everybody. So you always have to kind of adjust your orange pilling strategy to their needs and their situation. So like, for example, a young couple is trying to get a new home and they're being priced out, and it's hard to get a credit with the interest rates and also with the housing prices going up. So you can tie Bitcoin into that pretty easily. It's like, you know, do you know why the houses are going up? Well, it's because the money is broken and people, you know, all this capital is fleeing our broken money to the real estate market. Or a middle-aged guy trying to save for retirement. You know, you can show him the inflation chart and then you can show him the Bitcoin chart on 10-year horizon. And you always have to approach it with empathy. That's something I've had to learn during my, 7 years in Bitcoin, is that you always have to be empathetic and kind of approach it from their perspective, you know, because they don't care about, you know, destroying the state or something like that. They just care about their, you know, they have their own problems, and you have to approach it from that perspective. You just have to know who you're talking to. Like, you know, you don't talk to everybody the same way. You don't talk to, you know, people who work in the financial industry. You don't talk to them the same way you talk to your grandma about Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that's a huge gap for a lot of people in the Bitcoin space is, and it's not something I've always done well, of course. I mean, I think many of us are just so excited about the technology, the hope for the future, that it's really easy to jump into, well, the whole reason everything's wrong is because, and it's like, you might be right, but until people have a concept of why that is or what's broken about the money, it's just, they're never going to resonate. So I think you're right. It's really important to meet people where they are and to explain in the context of their daily lives where Bitcoin could fit in. And then they can begin. Then you listen to a couple podcasts, read a couple of books, and you begin to learn. Obviously the rabbit hole goes deep, but I love beginning with empathy.
Yeah. Most people don't even care why the money is broken. They just want to, you know, make sure that their rent gets paid and they have food on the table. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we as Bitcoiners, even though we might think we're right, it's exactly like you say. It takes, like, you need to take your ego out of it and be humble and approach it from, you know, a place of empathy.
So how does that affect then the way you write your newsletter, your social media content, anything you're doing, because you're obviously, you're reaching a very broad audience and not everyone's in the same place. And how do you think about the market that you're after? Because I imagine like for your newsletter feels pretty Bitcoin oriented, like toward Bitcoiners. Relay, I imagine, though, is trying to bring new people in. So, you know, no coiners, new coiners, you know, to all the way to like longtime Bitcoiners. So how do you think about the way that you structure your messaging and content in both of those realms?
Well, again, it all depends who you think is on the receiving end. Like when we're talking to newbies at Relay, like we have to assume that they don't understand anything. And that is how it is most of the time. Like most people have no idea of any financial concepts. So you have to really imagine you're speaking to a 10-year-old. And there's an app online called Hemingway, which is basically you put your text there and it tells you like what's the readability score and it gives you like a grade. So like anything under 10th grade is good. So if you like, on the, you know, 11th grade, you need to simplify it. You need to make your sentences shorter. You need to cut the jargon. So you just need to be, you just need to explain these things like they have no idea about anything, because that is true. As for my newsletter, yeah, it is targeted for Bitcoiners. So that's why I don't have to do this. I can kind of, you know, I can crack a few inside jokes. I can talk about the industry news, but it really always depends who you're talking to, who you're trying to reach, and then adjust your message accordingly. Because if you are trying to reach everybody, you actually reach nobody. So you always have to have in mind who you're speaking to. And that depends on the channels. For example, on Twitter, we talk to Bitcoiners because we're Bitcoiners follow us there. But then when it comes to Instagram, LinkedIn, we try to explain things more beginner friendly way. It's just about knowing your audience and then adjusting your message. Just like we talk, you don't talk to your grandma the same way you talk to people who work in finance.
So what gave you the idea to start the newsletter? Because I guess that's sort of a side project for you, but it's something you've kept. I think you've done it every single week for now over a year without fail. So I'd love to hear what the inspiration was.
Yeah, I'll tell you if you tell me later why you started yours.
I will.
Yeah, I started my newsletter in February 2023, and there was a few reasons, some of them more selfish than others. So the first one is I wanted to really improve my writing. And writing essentially is a communication. It's like, it's the most important soft skill you could have. And even if I stop writing the newsletter in 2 years, everything I learned about communication and effective writing, I'll still have it. So I wanted to improve my writing, but I also knew that if I just write weekly and nobody reads it, like I'm not going to be, you know, there's nobody keeping me accountable. So I would quit. But having a newsletter keeps me accountable, because if I miss a week, there's going to be people who email me and they're going to be like, what's up? Where's my Bitcoin news? So I wanted to improve my writing, but also I think there's a need for a newsletter like this, because most Bitcoin content is still kind of dry and technical. There's not a lot of, I think there's not a lot of marketing minded people in Bitcoin, just because we're so early, you know, we're 14 years into Bitcoin's journey. And I just wanted something that is, you know, you don't dread reading it. It's just like, you know what you're going to get. It's going to be super casual, written in my tone of voice, you know, like your friend. And there's going to be jokes and it's going to be light, but still planting those seeds of knowledge. So it's not just fart jokes for 3 minutes straight. It's humor combined with education. It was basically something I wish I would have, you know, had in 2017. Something super simple, fun to read, not dry, but still educational. So I think it feels a need. And also, it's called Bitcoin Therapy because it's supposed to be therapeutic for the readers, but it's actually therapeutic for me to write it, because I work in social media. So there's, you know, a lot of noise, and sometimes the signal gets lost in the noise. There's just so much stuff happening on social media. And I think I was just craving to write something long term, you know, really, you know, put my thoughts in a long, long, long format, even though it's 3 minutes per email, but still it's long format. And I think it's just good for me to kind of get a break from my daily work on social media.
I think the importance of learning to write is a really good one. And candidly, that's part of why I've done what I've done. I do think too, that your newsletter, again, I'm a newer subscriber, but it seems to fill a void that you're sort of speaking to here in the market of Bitcoin content, right? Like there's so much sort of broad macro, there's so much technical, and you sort of fit this space of like accessible, but it feels like it's really for Bitcoiners. Like you've got a lot of the jokes and the memes and things that I think would resonate with a typical Bitcoiner, even an early Bitcoiner, but it's most people haven't read 20 Bitcoin books, you know, and really, you know, most people aren't reading Grokking Bitcoin and diving into the weeds on this stuff. And I think your newsletter touches, like hits that middle ground between it's substantive, but it's not dense, if that makes sense.
It's like, think about it as an inverted pyramid. So at the top, we have Bitcoiners like you and me who read 20 books. I mean, I haven't read 20 books, but you know, for the example, we read 20 books, and then there's people who will not read 20 books, but they might read our content, and they will kind of funnel down. They will have this, you know, tidbits, you know, bite-sized, you know, narratives that they can then spread to other people. But I get it. My newsletter is not for everybody. Like for me, it's hard to see a cypherpunk like Adam Back reading it. It just doesn't add any value to him. But it's something that I personally like. And I think there's like, at least based on the feedback, or maybe people are just too nice to give me negative feedback, but people seem to really enjoy it. It's not the most kind of dense. It's kind of light, but it's still, like I said, it has those seeds of knowledge.
Yeah, it's useful. I think it's useful. And I think that's where like my newsletter that I started just only very recently. And part of the reason I started it, just to answer your question, is besides, I agree completely, improving, honing my writing skills. But, you know, I wanted to be involved in Bitcoin, and I started just actually weeks before the opportunity with the Bitcoin Way came up. And so decided that, you know, that could be, it's an inexpensive and inaccessible means of just being a part of the Bitcoin community. But I also sensed a gap in the market too. So much of the content, to your point on, you know, Adam Back probably isn't reading your newsletter.
Who knows? Maybe he's.
who knows? Maybe he is. But like I think about people in my life, I have effectively, I have no Bitcoiners in my immediate circle of family and friends. I have a lot of people who philosophically probably align with the principles, but just don't care about. They're not going to go read the books, or, you know, it's just not like their thing. Maybe it would be if they spent some time in it and they went down the rabbit hole. But I wanted to set off on a journey to write a newsletter that would give them like in a 2 to 5 minute read, some bit of like, why am I excited about Bitcoin? What promise does it offer? How does it work? Like very high level, like let's not get into the weeds on mining or, you know, how it does everything, but that it does these things. And so we'll see if I am successful in that. Again, I'm much earlier on my journey, and certainly don't have the marketing skills that you have. So I'll be interested to take it offline and hear from you on any tips. But that actually leads me to my next question is, one of the things I have a really hard time explaining to friends and family is my excitement for Bitcoin. You know, like so I don't own 100% Bitcoin, right? Like, but I'm not talking about, you know, stocks, bonds, real estate. I'm not talking about anything else except Bitcoin. I'm not excited about any of those things except Bitcoin. And I think most people see Bitcoin as pretty much a financial asset. And so it's like, why are you so excited about this thing? I understand you think it's going to go up in value, but how do you explain that to people? Because it's obviously so much more than simply a financial asset.
Yeah. So the issue is that most people see it, as you said, as a, like just a financial asset. And then other people just see it as a, like a plaything for nerds, you know, which it is, but it's also a lot more. Now, like, how do I explain my excitement? Well, I don't know if people can see my excitement because most of the time I have a poker face, but like, Bitcoin is a promise of a better world. And once you see it, you cannot be not excited. You cannot unexcite yourself. Like, again, it's cliche, but once you fall down the rabbit hole and you learn about the things Bitcoin could bring to humanity, it's a paradigm shift. You cannot put the genie back in the bottle. And yeah, I mean, again, when it comes to different people, you have to have a different approach, but it is contagious. When somebody is really excited, it is always contagious and it encourages people to go down the rabbit hole. But the sad reality is that most people don't care about anything except what's in front of them. And this is natural, you know, they don't care about these big topics. I think what's common with Bitcoiners is that we're super curious people. And like you, Michael, if you were not a curious person, you wouldn't be into Bitcoin because you would just kept living your life without ever, you know, wondering that why does the world work like this? And, you know, but I think more people are waking up to, they know there's this overarching feeling that something is wrong. Like, it shouldn't be like this. You know, we shouldn't be priced out of everything. Why are things getting more expensive? You know, but people can't really put a finger on it. And then that's where we come in and explain that, you know, maybe the root cause is the money. But again, like to your question, how do I explain my excitement? It's the feeling I have when I talk about Bitcoin and my work is hope. It's a hope for a better world. And I think, I mean, you have kids, right?
Yes.
You want to leave a better world for them. And I think, well, I don't have kids, but I assume that once you have kids, you start thinking a lot more long term. And like, yeah, that's why Michael Saylor has registered the domain hope.com and it redirects to a Bitcoin page because it's hope. And it's, for me, it's hard to not be excited, but that's also, we're a small niche of, you know, Bitcoin is still a niche. So we're kind of weird. So the fact that we're excited is kind of hard to explain to normies. But I think with time, as people learn about Bitcoin and as things get worse, which they will, I mean, I don't want to be a doomer, but fiat is literally designed to devalue. And devaluation means more riots, more social unrest. People will have to, at some point, notice Bitcoin.
This episode of the Bitcoin Way podcast is sponsored by us, your friends at the Bitcoin Way. If you rely on a third-party or closed-source hardware wallet for your Bitcoin custody, you are compromising on how you store your wealth. The Bitcoin Way offers white-glove service to help you take full self-custody of your Bitcoin and sleep in peace knowing you've done it right. Like most Bitcoiners, we believe that your Bitcoin stack will one day be worth a lot more than it is today. Go to thebitcoinway.com to sign up for a free consultation with a member of our team. Don't delay on protecting your wealth and reach out today. I think for me, like, I think one of the biggest promises of Bitcoin is, you know, if you take it to its most extreme potential upside, is disincentivizing something like war, right? Like if the government can't, I don't think most people think about the government printing money effectively to subsidize war. And there are a host of reasons why you might do that, from power to paying special interests, you know, but if I began that conversation with a friend, like, hey, why do you like Bitcoin? Why are you always talking about this Bitcoin thing? Well, I think it's going to disincentivize war. I think they'd look at me like I had four heads, you know, like it's like, what does Bitcoin have to do with war? But it's like this path you have to take to go to recognize there is a problem. Here is the problem, or here are at least pieces of the problem, and here are the symptoms and how they manifest in the world. And then this is how we get to Bitcoin and why Bitcoin fixes so many of those things. You're right, not everything, but if you can't print it, there are so many things that government becomes incapable of. And I think that alone is such a powerful fact that most people have a really hard time appreciating, especially in the West. I think especially like in the United States, where for the last 40 years, we've been able to relatively speaking, to coast, you know, through prosperity. And I think we have recency bias and assume that that's just the music plays forever, but eventually the music stops and chairs are missing and, you know, and not everyone gets a seat. And so I think you explained well, but I think I still just have a hard time articulating that in so many words to someone who's trying to figure out what the hell I'm so excited about.
Me too. But you know, my dad, he's Russian, and I don't need to explain Bitcoin to him. He gets it because he's lived through, you know, communism and just like, you know, really bad economy. So I don't have to explain it to him. I think what Tony at Bitcoin Way, he likes to say that we need more pain. And, you know, like, obviously we don't want more pain, but people, it's like kids, they touch a hot stove and they learn that, you know, you shouldn't touch it. And the world needs, still, there's not enough pain in the world. There is in, you know, in the global South, and they get Bitcoin. You don't have to explain it to them. But in the West, we take fiat as a status quo, even though the average lifespan of a fiat currency is like 30 years. Now, there's anomalies like the British pound and USD. But it's also, it's just an experiment. And again, it's a recency bias, but we need more pain. And Bitcoin is a hedge against that. And I think people are already waking up, which we can see directly in the price. The price of Bitcoin going up means there is more interest. Like, of course, there's also institutions pushing the price up, but there's also retail. Actually, right now on, you know, Google Trends, it's at 50. So the, you know, so there's, so it's a relative index, but like the interest from retail is going up because there people are clearly searching for Bitcoin. And I think that was the genius of Satoshi. I don't know if he knew, I would like to think so, but when he introduced the 4-year halving cycle, I think maybe he knew that people, it would generate so much hype. And it kind of bootstrapped the Bitcoin network into existence through speculation and greed. And that's also helping, you know, bring people to more people, bring Bitcoin to more people.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's, I don't know that I'll ever get, I think it'll be an ever evolving process of me trying to more clearly refine how I articulate Bitcoin and my excitement for people. But I completely agree that what Tony says is right. We don't want more pain, but I think it's going to require more pain. I mean, I think more pain is probably inevitable. And again, I agree. I don't want to be a doomer, but I think more pain is probably inevitable. And I think we're getting to the point where people are beginning to see some cracks, you see like these videos go viral of people who are, you know, crying about, I can't even, I have $100 left after I buy my groceries, pay my rent. Like I can't even afford for my kids to do sports or, you know, or whatever the thing is that they want. And I think once enough people recognize that everyone else is suffering too, that's when a lot of the sort of upheaval begins to play out. So I suppose time will tell. And again, this could be over the next year. It could be over the next 10 years or 50 years. I don't, you know, I think that's what we really don't know is like, what's the time horizon on a lot of this stuff. But you're right. Fiat is programmed to devalue over time. And that means people lose their buying power and there are consequences that come with that.
Yeah. Like you said, we're seeing cracks in the system. And that's where we have to be vigilant and point out the solution that Bitcoin is, because a lot of people, they see these problems, they see them, but then they, you know, they think more government is the solution or more socialism is the solution. And that's where we have to come in and kind of offer, you know, the alternative view that, you know, maybe it's not more government that's gonna fix these issues. Maybe it's less. But yeah, about those girls who cry in their cars, you know, about not being able to afford groceries or do hobbies. I've seen like 5 of those in the last month. And I don't even hang out on TikTok. They just, you know, they pop up on my feed. They're everywhere. People know something is wrong, but they can't really tell exactly what.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it seems like, I think maybe the baby boom generation feels as though it's a matter of laziness, you know, like you can't afford it because of you're not working hard enough. And the reality is that is probably true for a lot of people. I see plenty of laziness, but I think I see laziness in every generation. But a lot of these people talk about, my husband works, I work, and we drive Uber on the weekend.
And our kids work.
We live in a very modest home. Like, this is not a matter of, you know, sloth. Like, this is a matter of unaffordability. And if you do look at some of the data, like I think I've seen recently that the average home price is 4x the median income today, like in the United States. Back in, I don't know, 1960, 1970, I mean, 40, 50 years ago, it was, I think, like 2x. So by at least that measure, you have to recognize it's not a matter of just work harder. It's like, no, well, you'd have to work twice as hard as the boomers did, which is not probably possible because they were working 40 to 60 hours a week. You're not going to go work 120 hours a week and then think you're suddenly going to make up that delta and be able to afford a home. The reality is it's just become completely unaffordable for most people nowadays, most young people in particular.
Yeah, attributing like this whole thing to sloth is really unfair. I saw a Twitter account do kind of like a compilation of like old newspapers, and literally every generation said about the next one that they're lazy. Like every single one, we will say about our kids that they're lazy. It's just what people do. And like, if you put your tinfoil hat on and ask yourself, like, who benefits from, you know, how rising house prices and, you know, both parents having to work, you know, you could say that the government wants to have more taxpayers, you know, they make double revenue now. But yeah, let's not get into conspiracy theories too deep.
Yeah. We could go a long ways on that. I think it was a while back. I think I saw Lynn Alden post on Twitter, what'd she say? A brief history of no one wants to work anymore. And it was verbatim, no one wants to work anymore. And it was newspaper articles dating back to, I think, like the early 20th century, all the way up to today. And you're right, every generation says it. And it's like, I look back at some of these generations and I think of them as some of the hardest working people you could possibly imagine. They were the ones who built the skyscrapers of New York and did, and their parents were saying, yeah, no one wants to work anymore. So I think it's an easy thing to write off. I don't think it's probably very defensible though.
Yeah, like you said, our brains are just always trying to conserve energy, and saying that that this generation is lazy is just the easy thing to do. It's so much harder to actually dig into the data and see that, like, we're totally being priced out of, you know, all kinds of things in the West. So yeah, it's just intellectually lazy. And like, I love boomers, but like, most of their advice to young people is bad. It doesn't apply anymore. Just like our kids, like the advice we give them, unless it's like evergreen, like advice on how to get ahead in life, in the economy, is not going to apply anymore because it's different.
Right. So let's shift our attention a bit to your work and your expertise in marketing. And it seems like something you've got a knack for. So again, we sort of circled around this topic of understanding your market, who you're going after, how you're messaging. In general, though, what are some of the tricks that you've learned to promote Bitcoin? You know, like what are the things you've found resonate with the different groups, the different audiences that you might be trying to engage with? Like about Bitcoin specifically, what are the sorts of topics, I guess, that you hit on? And then what are the means with, is it memes? Is it research? Is it, you know, what sorts of content then around those topics do you push that you find to be most helpful?
Well, people like when, you know, their portfolios go up. That's one. People love making money. So if you talk about that, they're, you know, they like it. But I mean, marketing, you know, there's a bunch of tactics and they come and go. So I always prefer on kind of like foundational, kind of like learning human psychology and learning what ticks people. Like, kind of always trying to, like, storytelling is super important, always trying to remember that you're talking to a person, a real person, even though, like, you know, I'm sending an email to 4,000 people, it might seem like, you know, something out there, but there's 4,000 people who actually open it and they have a face and they have a story. So you always have to, you know, really just be a human and always try to, like, for example, why relay content works super well on social media is that we're always trying to kind of go to that primordial knee-jerk reaction. You know, if your content doesn't make people feel anything, then it's bad. So, like, I'd rather have people hate me than be indifferent. So, of course, I'd prefer people love me. And the second best is people hate you. But then the worst thing is if you're just indifferent. And I think you just have to, again, it's just human. It's just understanding humans and the kind of, you know, it is something you can learn, but most of marketing is just soft skills, you know, because all the tactics, you know, should you use memes or not? It changes, but like this kind of foundational understanding of, you know, human psychology, people don't change, you know, unless we're talking like millions of years. So you just have to understand kind of like, what is the main desire that people have and how, like, for example, if we're talking about like products, how does your product fix their need? And you always have to talk their language. So, for example, if you want to sell something to people, you have to talk to them and use the exact words that they're using. You need to make them feel like they're totally understood. But as for like, you know, do you want to talk like how to grow on social media, how to grow a newsletter, like something specific?
Well, no, I mean, not necessarily how to grow a newsletter or social media, but I'm just curious, like I'm trying to figure out, I mean, I think both personally and professionally, you know, there's value here, but like just trying to understand like what's resonating with people generally, like what are the... What's the content that you share or the type of content that people just tend to respond the most to, where you share something and either Relay gets an influx of people, you know, reaching out or interested, or, you know, a newsletter that you share that people respond and say, oh, this was great, or I hadn't thought of this, or I've been thinking about this, I'm glad you wrote this piece.
Yeah, it's all about adding value. At the end of the day, if you like, and value can be lots of things. Like a meme is valuable because it makes you laugh. So whether it's education or making somebody laugh or making somebody inspired, you always need to be adding value. And like what most people do wrong in marketing is that they just ask, like, and there's this thing called law of reciprocity. So if I give you something, Michael, you know, no strings attached, you're more likely to give me back. So you always have to be really adding value and speak to, always try to target one emotion. And like, for example, with memes, if you create, usually the best memes are the ones you create really fast, because there's an idea and there's a, you know, meme is essentially like a prepackaged narrative. People think it's just an image, funny image, but no, it actually communicates a narrative. But that's why it's so powerful, because it's nobody wants to read an article, but meme is super shareable and it explains the same thing as 5,000 words in an article in the image format. But you need to always be. But then on the meme example, if you start thinking too much about the meme and you overthink, the meme is going to be worse. So it's always the first meme that comes to you, because memes need to be based on truth. There's this saying that, for example, I don't want to get political, but like the left can't meme, or they're, you know, maybe because they're not based on truth. And if I'm talking about memes, but it's any message essentially, if it like doesn't make you feel something immediately, then, and it doesn't resonate, you probably need to change the message. And that's why, again, like understanding human psychology, understanding the audience you're talking to, and then targeting one specific emotion is super important.
Okay. So last question, or at least topic here, I was hoping to cover. So you wrote a recent newsletter Every American will soon own Bitcoin. I think I might have it pulled up here, and was wondering, I think that's a significant statement. And I'm curious what it was. I don't know if you have it pulled up or if you were, it was a lot in the last few weeks, but if you remember exactly what you were writing about, and if you could share why that is, why that's an important thing to think about. And then we can maybe take it from there.
Yeah, let me open the article here just so I get the numbers right at least. But
yeah, I'm going to pull it up too.
But the basic idea is that, like, every American will own Bitcoin, whether they know it or not. And that's because, like, most of, like, America is invested passively in different indexes. And, like, one of the biggest is S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be included in S&P 500, there's a few criteria you need to meet. So you need to have a 15 million market cap. You need to have positive earnings for the last four quarters or... and also like the last one. And basically, like, this article specifically was about MicroStrategy, but this applies to every company that decides to buy Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And it's really smart, because how the S&P 500 works is that there's the allocation that these funds, so it's like pension funds, 401k plans, they're all like, the allocation to the companies is weighted according to the market cap. So the bigger a company's market cap is, the more of those shares all these passively invested funds will have. And like right now, MicroStrategy is not in S&P 500. I think soon it will be, because, for example, like yesterday, with the Bitcoin price appreciation, the MicroStrategy shares went up even more than Bitcoin. So 10% overnight, which is crazy, because MicroStrategy essentially is a pseudo ETF. So the more Bitcoin MicroStrategy owns, like, this is assuming it gets into S&P 500, which it does. Mm-hmm. That is because Michael Saylor has essentially found a infinite money glitch. And I'm reading from the article. So like, the first step is buying Bitcoin. So he buys Bitcoin on MicroStrategy's balance sheet, which causes MicroStrategy to go up, especially like in the last 2 years when there was no Bitcoin ETFs. So MicroStrategy was essentially the only option in the stock market. To, if you want Bitcoin price exposure, you had to buy MicroStrategy. Then what Saylor does is he takes out more debt, and he uses that debt to buy more Bitcoin, which causes MicroStrategy to go up. So you can see that the market capitalization of MicroStrategy is slowly climbing up, and soon it's going to be big enough to actually be included in the S&P 500. Now, when MicroStrategy goes up, what Michael Saylor can do is he can issue more stock, which I think he has already done. And obviously, when he issues more stock, there's going to be more capital he can use to buy Bitcoin. MicroStrategy goes up, and he does this, rinse and repeat. And at some point, MicroStrategy is going to be so big, it's going to be in S&P 500. And what this means is that all of these people who are invested passively in S&P 500, they will have a Bitcoin allocation, whether they like it or not. And the more people buy into MicroStrategy, the more MicroStrategy will appreciate, and the more Bitcoin it can buy, and the more Bitcoin it buys, the more it appreciates. So, I'm just repeating myself, but essentially, like, all this passive capital will be allocated to MicroStrategy and Bitcoin. So yeah, that's essentially the playbook, and that's why I wrote. I mean, it was it's not clickbait, but kind of tongue in cheek. But that's why I believe that most of America will own Bitcoin at some point, whether they like it or not.
Well, no, I think it's an interesting way of framing it, and that was sort of obviously the subject or the title pulled me in, and makes a lot of sense. I think maybe more importantly, though, you extrapolate that out, we're maybe at a place in Bitcoin's history that other companies, especially, I think at the end of the year, there are some new accounting rules coming online in the United States that will effectively allow companies to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And and value it at market rates instead of only allow, like, I guess the way it sort of works is if there's a gain on it, you can't account for that. But if there's a loss, you have to. And so for people who are worried about what their balance sheet looks like, which Michael Saylor obviously is a lot less concerned about that than because he has, I think, a majority or at least a very large control over MicroStrategy. I think a lot more companies, bigger companies, are going to do the Michael Saylor playbook, right? I mean, they're going to do what MicroStrategy's been doing. And then I think you begin to get this effect where, okay, everyone gets the upside of Bitcoin as more and more companies do that in fiat terms, but they don't actually own, real Bitcoin. Hopefully though, it brings to light what Bitcoin is doing. And then people say, I want a piece of this. I don't want to just see my portfolio rise. I want Bitcoin, and maybe it's sort of an on-ramp for a lot of people, like an awakening for a lot of people that the reason your portfolio is increasing is because all these companies have made the right move and gone in on Bitcoin to store their treasury.
Yeah, there's definitely there is, because we're talking about public markets, there's definitely going to be pressure from investors who are looking at MicroStrategy and like, why is this shit going up 10% overnight? I want that too. Why are you not allocated to Bitcoin? Why is there no Bitcoin on your balance sheet? And then, because it's public markets, people will start looking into these companies who are, appreciating so much overnight, seemingly for no reason, that the revenues don't change and the profit, but it's the Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And then they start asking, like, what is this Bitcoin? And same with the Bitcoin ETFs, hopefully they then like go into the rabbit hole and start learning about self-custody and realizing that, it's better to hold, real Bitcoin. So it's definitely kind of like a Trojan horse.
So do you think, I don't know if you saw this in the news, this is sort of an aside, but tangentially related. Did you see that Vanguard, I can't remember his name now, Vanguard CEO is stepping down after, I think, like 30 years or something as CEO. And what a lot of Bitcoiners are speculating, and I have no idea. I'm curious to hear your opinion. He got fired or at least is leaving because of their stance, not only to not do a Bitcoin ETF as a company, but also to block their customers from buying Bitcoin ETFs. Do you think that's part of this? Do you think there's truth to that? If you were to speculate.
I was about to say I don't want to speculate, but yes, definitely. If everybody's making gains and you're the only one for, whatever reason, you're saying no to Bitcoin ETFs, you're blocking it from your clients, they're not going to be happy. And maybe there was some internal pressure for him to step down. We don't know, but it makes sense.
Yeah, I think if in the next 6 months, I think maybe he's got a few more months or end of the year or something like that, I think is when he's officially done. If they apply for a Bitcoin ETF or they begin allowing their clients to purchase them, I think that'll give me a bit more confidence that perhaps the Bitcoiners were right and it was Bitcoin that ultimately led to his downfall as CEO there. So last thing. So I'm checking price. We're at a little over $66,000 right now at the time of this recording, US dollars. So I don't know what price you're generally tracking, but one thing that I'm really curious about, something that most Bitcoiners seem to believe, is that we have these ups, these 4-year cycles, ups and downs. We climb really, really high and then we drop down, usually above the last cycle's high. And so like our lows keep increasing and our highs keep increasing. At some point though, the hypothesis is that stops and we just keep going up. Do you think this is the last cycle? Do you think the cycles of ups and downs are gone? Or do you think we have another 4-8 years of kind of ups and downs until we really take off into space?
I think, I'm tracking US dollars actually in Euro, which is, my currency. Bitcoin already hit an all-time high, so I'm already celebrating. Euro, it seems like USD and the Swiss franc are the last fiat currency standing, but about the 4-year, you know, market cycles, I think they'll still be here, but they'll be less strong. So like, for example, the first cycle ever, Bitcoin goes up 3,000% or something like this. I actually don't remember. And then the last cycle, it was actually only 400%. So it's definitely getting less significant because there's less, you know, the Bitcoin miners keep mining, you know, after halving, it's going to be 450. But most of Bitcoin supply is actually already there. So the new supply doesn't move the price, you know, even if it's being gobbled up by institutions and retails, it doesn't have the same effect as before because 95% of Bitcoin supply has already been mined. Now, we will have mini bull markets and mini bear markets inside the 4-year halving cycles, but I think they will still be here for as long as halvings. I mean, I think at least for 20 years, but after that, when the new supply is so minuscule and the Bitcoin market cap has grown so much and the liquidity has grown so much that, like, you know, before, like, one, it was enough for one whale to sell and, it, you know, push the market price 10%. You know, as liquidity increases, the market is going to be, Bitcoin market is going to be a lot more robust. I mean, it's a global market, so it will be definitely a lot more robust. And but yeah, I think the data speaks for itself. I wrote about this in the newsletter, but every 4 years Bitcoin is getting less and less volatile. So like, for example, well, I don't remember specifically, but like 20% drawdowns used to be super common before, and in the last cycle we saw like only 5 of them, and I think in the future cycle we're gonna see maybe few, and then in the future it's gonna be really rare to see 20% moves in the market. So I think as Bitcoin grows, it's going to be more stable, and that's great for, you know, your everyday retail investors who can actually use Bitcoin as a savings technology because, you know, they don't like these swings.
Yeah, I think right now we're only able to bring into the fold people who are willing to look at it from a long-term perspective. People who are concerned about short-term price movements are still, they're going to stay away as long as it feels volatile. And unfortunately, they equate volatility and risk with one another, which they obviously aren't. But yeah, I agree with you. I think in the coming years, I think we're going to see less and less of that, of those big swings. And I think more and more people will be able to stomach those mini bulls and mini bear markets that you're describing.
Yeah, and I think with this, like, because right now there's a vibrant Bitcoin community and we're all bonding together, you know, in the depths of the bear market, we're all together and, you know, cheering each other up. But as Bitcoin grows, you know, also the Bitcoin community is going to kind of fizzle down, you know. There's not going to be, nobody is going to call themselves a Bitcoiner, just like you don't call yourself a US dollar or something, you know. You're just using money. So that is kind of sad that, you know, the Bitcoin community is probably not going to exist in 20 years because it's just going to be money. It's something super boring because money is boring. It's just money. But yes, I definitely think that Bitcoin is going to become more boring in the future. And that's good. That's what you want your money to be. You want it to be somewhat stable and, you know, long term, be able to retain your purchasing power.
Arsen, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. That's maybe the most important takeaway that people can have. You want to have money that retains its purchasing power, and that's what Bitcoin promises. So before we jump off, could you give a handoff? You've got your newsletter. Tell everyone where to find you online, Relay.
If you want to follow my newsletter, it's pretty chill. There's a few fart jokes here and there, but there's also some good information. It's btctherapy.io. And if you want to follow Relay, it's relay_app on Twitter.
Terrific. And I would encourage everyone to check out Relay. Check out the Bitcoin Therapist, his newsletter. Arsen's newsletter is great. Again, I'm a newer subscriber, but really enjoying it and feel like it does kind of fit that middle ground of very useful, but entertaining, fun, and not too technical for the people who are probably watching this podcast and not really looking for a deep dive. So, Arsen, appreciate your time. Appreciate what you're doing. You take care and hope we can stay in touch.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
All righty, that's a wrap. I really enjoyed my conversation with Arsen. He is an awesome guy, super laid back, and I really appreciate the way he approaches Bitcoin, explaining Bitcoin to people, and the work that he's doing both at Relay and personally with the Bitcoin Therapist newsletter. As always, feel free to drop me a line. You can find me on X at the other M Jordan. I'm always interested in feedback, comments, questions. I'm still very, very new at this. This is episode number 2 for me. So would love your thoughts and opinions, areas that I could improve. And then I'd also ask that you'd follow us at the Bitcoin Way. And it's at the Bitcoin Way _ on X. Check out my personal newsletter. It's my Substack, Black Hat Bitcoin, if you feel so inclined. Thank you for listening to the Bitcoin Way podcast. This is Michael Jordan signing off. Until next time.